From UFOs to psychic powers and government conspiracies, history is riddled with unexplained events. You can turn back now, or learn the stuff they don't want you to know. A production of iHeartRadio.
Hello and welcome back to the show. My name is Noel. Our colleague Matt is on an adventure and shall be returning soon. They call me Ben. We are joined, as always, with our super producer, Dylan, the Tennessee pal, Fagan. Most importantly, you are you. You are here. That makes this the stuff they don't want you to know. Noel, tonight, you and Dylan and I are embarking on the first part of what may be a continuing series. Remember a while back in our listener mail program, we received a letter from a conspiracy realist who was going to, she was going to jury duty. She was auditioning for jury duty and she received, I can't not think of it that way.
It's true. You know what I mean? It's true. Yeah. I passed one and I failed one. So, yeah, I guess that's,
I hope.
That's not too bad.
Yeah, I always want the callback, though, right? The approval, the validation. I am
sort of
juror.
Until you realize what it entails.
Yeah, exactly. So this conspiracy realist received a weird question in her jury duty process, and they asked her if she had ever been in a state militia, which prompted her to write to us. And we found that this is a concept worth exploring in an episode or possibly a series thereof, because state militias are confusing. They've got a lot of different names. It's surprising that they exist in the United States, because the U.S. remains, by every single metric, no matter what else you think of when you think of the U.S., you have to admit it has the world's most powerful and dangerous military, like several times over.
For sure. It's sort of a claim to fame, right? Seem to boast about it a little bit on the world stage. Additionally, various states in the United States may well be, are in fact, home to unsanctioned militaries or militias, right? Sort of, I don't know what you call them, like improvised military. It's weird. We'll get to it. These are groups of armed individuals united by any number of ideologies and goals. And we're gonna talk about some of those goals and ideologies and what doth a militia make, or what makes a militia.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because despite having this huge military, individual states in this country can be home to their own sanctioned militias and, as you said, Noel, their own unsanctioned militias. So we're going to pause for a word from our sponsors, and when we return, we're going to explore the fact, fiction, and perhaps the danger of some of these organizations. Here are the facts. All right, first question. This was our first question too. What the heck is a state militia? Is it even legal?
Well, in the United States, a state militia, also known as a state defense force, is a military. What does paramilitary mean? I mean, wouldn't this kind of be extra military, paramilitary?
Paramilitary is a very interesting phrase. Sometimes it's used as a curse word. Essentially, it means a military that is not part of a country's official or legit armed forces. So this happens a lot, for instance, in Central and South America, where an armed group, even a terrorist or secessionist group, will describe themselves as the military, and the actual government will say, no. No.
Not it. Yeah. So, I mean, I guess we could definitely say that some of these types of groups we're talking about today could be considered paramilitary, though some of them are considered a military unit that operates under the authority of a state government rather than that of the federal government. That's, of course, when they're the legal versions of these things. In that situation or those situations, these groups are authorized by state and federal law and under the command of the governor of each state.
Yes. Yeah. And this gets confusing. It's important. Walk with us here, folks.
these things, the state defense forces, are not the same thing as the National Guard.
I was going to ask.
National Guard. Yeah. Yeah. And it's like, why are they different? The big difference is the National Guard of any state can be federalized, can be drawn into the larger armed forces in times of need. And that's been the law of the land ever since the National Defense Act amendments of 1933.
They usually refer to it as calling in the National Guard.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. Often you'll see that in maybe the aftermath of a natural disaster or other emergency situation. Uncle Sam recognizes the legality of state defense forces, again, separate from the National Guard, in the Constitution, with one big caveat: they do have to be separate from the Guard. And if you are a state defense force, like we have, one of the most famous would be the Texas Guard, right? That force cannot be drafted, cannot be called, cannot be ordered into the larger U.S. armed forces. This is under, for any policy wonks, this is 32 U.S. Code 109, Maintenance of Other Troops, which you can read in full online. It's got a weird, wonky loophole, though. All right, so this is one for all the draft dodgers out there.
Yeah. If you this does not exempt you, right?
Yeah. Can you tell us a little more about
that? Well, it occurred to me what an interesting loophole this is, because while the body, the organization, the actual state militia, as a fighting unit cannot be co-opted by the U.S. Army or armed services, individuals within it, because of their service under these sanctioned state groups, are not, however, exempt from being drafted as individual human people, citizens, into the armed forces.
Which is weird. And also, if you are already a member of the reserves, you can't be a member of the state defense force at the same time. So they built this intricate system of yes, no's, right? And every state, well, almost every state, has laws that authorize some version of a state defense force. 19 states plus Puerto Rico right now have active forces with different levels of activity and support and strength. You know, we mentioned the Texas State Guard. There's also an Ohio Naval Guard, which is interesting. We have the equivalent in our home state of Georgia. Basically, these things are the commanding authority of what has been called unorganized militias, which are still also legal, technically, but it's a very broad term. And if things go wrong, you, my friend, and Dylan Tennessee Powell Fagan, and I would be called in to be part of an unorganized militia, like if stuff really went bad.
Right, because of our designation as able-bodied men between the ages of 17 and 45.
Yes, who are not already in the armed forces or the National Guard.
Got it. Okay. So maybe without getting too terribly into the weeds, we can already see how this can get a little confusing. Certainly threw me for a loop. Certainly. A complex and interlocking web of fighting forces full of kind of bizarre overlapping areas, Venn diagrammy bits, and loopholes. So I guess the question is, how did we get here? This is not my beautiful house. This is not my beautiful United States Army. This is, what is this? What is, right. What is a militia?
No, many a day go by, right?
Yeah, so there we go.
This idea makes sense. And to understand it, we have to travel back to the origin of the United States. In general, an unorganized militia means that in times of dire need, extreme emergency, a state may not be able to rely entirely upon the federal army, the U.S. armed forces, so they need a citizen army they can call up immediately. This is not the same as an unsanctioned, self-proclaimed militia, because this army, this unorganized militia, has the approval of the state's governor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that term, though, unorganized militia, it just makes me think they're like running around like chickens with their heads cut off. They don't know which way is up.
Right, right. Shooting each other in the foot. And
yeah.
Some guy pooped his pants.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Yes, yeah, yeah. What was that Benny Hill theme? Can we do that real quick?
Oh, boy.
Dylan's got it. Yeah.
There it is.
There it is. I always picture Dylan rolling his eyes when we do those just leap of faith sound cues. But you're excellent at it. Thank you, sir.
We love you and we believe in you, Dylan. But you know, now that you've got that image in your head of the Benny Hill style, you know, gunman running around frantically, let's talk about what it really means, what an organized militia really means, and how it pertains or is not relevant in our current time.
Yeah. So unorganized militias are more or less obsolete in the modern day because we have not reached that level of emergency, but you'll still see them around. The most famous is, or one of the most famous would be the Virginia militia. Their members do wear uniforms. They actively perform military duties. You find them pretty often in various Virginia state military schools. This wasn't always the case because when the U.S. was founded itself, a child of conspiracy in the 1770s, all the way up to the early 20th century, the U.S. only had a minimal, like, actual facts army, as Lauren Vogelbaum would say. Instead, when they got into a tangle, when they got into a scrap, they called upon these state militias to give them the majority of troops for their fighting force. This was not ideal because all the, like, the troops in Georgia and the troops in, Rhode Island may have very different standards of training, right? So yeah. Some people might as well be special forces and other guys are like first day ROTC.
Well, and also it would vary pretty widely in their ability to deploy, like, quickly and efficiently from group to group. So let's move forward in time, fast forward, if you will, to the Spanish-American War. As a result of the performance from militias and these other volunteer units, Congress did realize that there perhaps was a little inconsistency, let's just say, and they needed to do something about it.
Yeah, diplomatically put, think of it this way, folks. When you go, one of the appeals of fast food is that a McDonald's burger is a McDonald's burger, right? Something like it. It's uniform wherever you go. And they in Congress realized they needed everybody on the same page fighting wise. They wanted people at the same level. This leads to the Militia Act of 1903. That's the ancestor of the modern day National Guard that we have today. During World War I, Congress said, okay, every state, you can maintain what we'll call home guards. They're different from the National Guard. And everyone said, yay.
A collective whoop, if you will. But there's a bit more to the story. And for that, we need to move towards the Cold War era. Everyone up until that point kind of agreed that state militias were necessary just in case things, you know, really, really went south, like you were talking about earlier, Ben.
But in Russians.
There you go. Yeah.
Red Dawn.
They're coming. But everything changed in the 1980s when some of these groups started to have some issues with corruption.
Yeah, and mission creep. They were getting a little too big for their britches. One of the most infamous examples is 1987. The government of Utah had to clear the house, militarily speaking. Looking at the Utah State Guard, he found that all but 31 officers had to be fired immediately because the State Guard was absolutely riddled with neo-Nazis, felons, and mental patients. And there we are. Yeah, this is a quote. This is not us. This is a quote from a paper at the time, the Kentucky New Era.
Yeah, that tracks. So let's fast forward once again for the last time to the present day. So with the nature of these unorganized militias, these extra military groups, kind of starting to be seen as having a bit of a troubled past, you might ask yourself, what do they actually do? I think we've been asking ourselves that from the start. In general, they do focus on managing emergency situations as well as participating in protecting homeland security. And most of these are ground troops. There are, however, some that take to the skies and to the seas, but mainly they are ground forces.
Yeah. Overwhelmingly, they are ground forces. And I want to plant a seed for us here, fellow conspiracy realists. When you hear the word militia in the United States, what we often are going to think about will be what we will call those unsanctioned militias, right? Not unorganized, because nothing has gone horribly, horribly wrong to the point of the U.S. dissolving, right? There are no massive foreign militaries attacking, you know, Missouri or anything, but right. we do see a lot of concerns that have arisen in recent years about people self-proclaiming as militia and then maybe lingering at polling places to whoosh, whoosh, protect those polling places. And they'll say it's not voter intimidation. It's making sure the vote goes right.
Okay. I'm a little intimidated just thinking about it, to be honest. So amid this confusion, we see a lot of disturbing problems emerge. While the majority of these folks are acting in good faith, there are, of course, some, to your point, Ben, who aren't. So what about the groups that claim to be state militia that by their very nature have very little to no oversight at all, especially from where the federal government's concerned?
And why is this so confusing? Part of it is the depending on the state, these sanctioned groups may have different names entirely: state military force, state militia, state military reserve, state guard, and so on. And with all these terms being flown about and with all these questions about chain of command and the ultimate authority, right, and the ultimate aims of the organization, it's easy to see chaos and conspiracy blossom. We'll tell you what we mean by that after a word from our sponsors. Here's where it gets crazy. All right, we know the old problem of standardized training continues in the modern day. Noel, I'd like to share with everybody a quick story. And please. Unfortunately, it's a story that's, okay, great. It's a story that's going to be common, unfortunately, to a lot of us in the audience this evening. So the world's militaries, many of them, especially in the West, they have realized that you need to trade notes in class, right? So a French officer may have an exchange program, or the French military may have an exchange program wherein an officer visits the U.S. and vice versa. And what they see there is even these modern militaries have discovered stark differences, not just in aspects of training, but in aspects of ideology and in aspects of culture. That's why these exchange programs are valuable, because you need to speak the same military language, especially if, again, things go wrong and you have to have an international ally to help you in whatever global operation or objective you're attempting to achieve. This standardized training stuff it's like an aggravating chore that you always have to do. Right. Like, you know, you're washing your car and you realize that you're just going to have to wash it again, but you have to keep washing it because otherwise your car is going to get dirty, you know, or putting gas in your car. You have to keep putting gas in your car so it doesn't break down, or keep charging it so it doesn't break down.
Annoying.
And it's annoying and it's necessary. And that's kind of where standardized training comes in. It's also just the tip of the iceberg. There's a huge problem with consistency when we talk about legal state militias. And the best way to illustrate it, along with your earlier note about corruption, is to go to a 2007 New York Times investigation, which found the problem was way worse, cartoonishly worse than most of us would imagine.
Well, not, yeah, a great investigative journalist for the Times, Paul Vitello, looked specifically into the New York Guard and found that the issue was less with consistency across other organizations of this type, but more with a complete and utter lack of formal military training. Pretty serious stuff.
Yeah.
In the article, Vitello talks to one former commander of the Guard, a Pierre David Lacks, who put it thusly, if you are friendly with the governor and you always wanted to be a general, you ask the governor to make you a general. And poof, you're a brigadier general.
Who knew it was that easy? Sorry, everybody who went to West Point.
Yeah,
it's rough.
It is.
Yeah, it sounds then that we are looking at something that is anathema to an actual armed force. The idea that one could simply, like European aristocrats of old, buy a title that you did not earn. There's another. This article is incredibly interesting. We found it on the New York Times Wayback Machine, but you can also find it on web.archive.org. And in this, we see that Vitello speaks with numerous people who are breaking down some of the uglier, or not even ugly, like some of the more disappointing aspects of this state defense force in particular. I want to give you some numbers real quick.
Yeah.
Before Mr. Lacks that you just quoted, there was a guy named George Liebner, and he talks at length about how he recruited politicians for the cause in the 1980s. The New York Guard depended and depends upon largesse. They need annual grants known as member items. Its budget is about $85,000 a year, which is obviously laughably small in comparison to other military budgets. Just getting that out there.
Yeah.
Right. And so this guy, Liebner, who was an accountant on Long Island, he said, look, I've got Guard members like State Senator Dean G. Skelos, who is now a colonel, and former assemblyman Thomas F. Baraga. These are both Long Island Republicans. Oh, and Thomas F. Baraga is a major general in the Guard. And he said they've sponsored some of these grants because, here's the quote, he says, I'm basically giving these guys rank and title because they're supporting us financially. His logic is not inspiring, but it is sound. He says, what could I give these guys except a title? I'm not stupid. If I ask some political guy to join the New York Guard and support our mission, and I offer to make him a private, do you think he's going to join?
Yeah,
probably. You know not. What I mean?
These guys don't get where they are without a little dash of ego. The article also makes note that the Guard's duties are often pretty ceremonial in nature rather than operational. We see some similar issues that are reflected in multiple other organizations in different states, a trend that kind of causes some critics to dismiss the whole concept as wannabe warriors, warrior wannabes. The idea that some of these state Guard folks are just people that couldn't cut it, you know, in the real military, and this was the best they could do, which the implication also being that there might be a bit of a chip on some shoulders because of this fact, right?
Right. And that's pretty rough. Obviously, we don't want to paint with a broad brush because a lot of these organizations are doing really good work, work that you would call volunteer work. You know, they're paying for their own uniforms. If they have uniforms, they're paying their own way to go to events. And like you said, a lot of these ceremonial functions are still very important. Emergency preparedness drills, color guards for funerals, you know, security for charity runs and things of that nature, right? So training stuff. This is good for the community overall. But should it count as military, right? Should you be able to be a general for donating to a cause? We're going to say no. And a lot of generals, some of whom may be in the audience tonight, certainly ones I've spoken to in the past, would absolutely laugh in a scary way about the idea. Have you ever heard a general laugh in person, Noel? It's not pleasant.
Is it like villainous? What are we talking here?
It's very, it's not funny. That's more a politician. I see where you're going. No, it's more, I don't even want to do it on air. I'll do it when we hang out.
Sounds good.
We'll see each other later.
Should we get to the question of legitimacy? I think we've sort of started to poke at that one a little bit, but a lot of what we've talked about thus far, at the very least, are involving politicians. There's state oversight to some degree. They are at the very least acknowledged, if not sanctioned, right, by the state?
Yeah.
What about the ones that aren't and that are kind of operating in their own ideological bubbles?
Excellent. And that's the segue, folks. We're going to pause for a word from our sponsors, and then we'll return with perhaps the most disturbing question about state militias, fact and fiction, the problem of legitimacy. And we've returned. All right, Noel, what do we mean when we talk about legitimacy in this regard?
Yeah, it's certainly the other side of this this very intense military commemorative coin. There are numerous groups who call themselves state or regional militias. However, these groups exist with no approval from the proper authorities. There's a really great compilation of fact sheets that Georgetown Law put out state by state on unlawful militias. So regardless of what your stance might be on this issue, it's definitely worth your time to check it out. Find your state, give it a little look, see how it stacks up for you in your neck of the global woods, as Ben would say.
Yeah. And we pulled up Georgia, of course, because we're very interested in what's happening in Georgia. That affects us immediately. But for every fact sheet you read, whichever state you go to, you'll find some of the same things. And Georgetown sums it up this way. It's a long quote, but we feel we need to share it in full. They say the following: groups of armed individuals that engage in paramilitary activity or law enforcement functions without being called forth by a governor or the federal government and without reporting to any government authority are acting as unauthorized private militias.
Okay.
And the quote continues.
Go on.
Yeah. I mean, they're pretty... That's pretty explicit, right? They're saying, look, if someone didn't tell you you were law enforcement, sorry, buckaroo, you are not law enforcement. Now you're just a group of guys with guns. Now you're just a posse. You know what I mean?
Right.
With no marks of legitimacy. So Georgetown continues and they say, look, these unlawful groups, quote, sometimes train together and respond to events using firearms and other paramilitary techniques, such as staking out tactical positions, operating in military style formations. They often purport to have authority to engage in military and law enforcement functions, such as protecting property and engaging in crowd control. So Georgetown here is talking about people who take it upon themselves to dress in a uniform, maybe show up at a protest, sometimes a protest for a cause with which they disagree, and say, hey, we're just keeping the peace. We're just keeping the peace. You know what I mean? Don't push me. I'm not going to push you. You were pushing on me.
That's right. Really insisting upon yourself. I mean, you know, we certainly heard about some members of some groups like this being around during the January 6th riots, whatever you want to call it, uprising. Mm-hmm. Does this include groups like Proud Boys and some of these, you know, armed kind of paramilitary seeming groups?
It can, yeah. It's a pickle. I was going to call it picklish. It's a bag of badgers because you can be a militant organization, right? And it's legal to be almost any kind of organization you would like to be in the United States, at least on paper. And we have to note, to be completely honest, we're looking at action and intention here. Action is easy to prove legally. Intention is a little bit more difficult to prove. You know, regardless of where anybody stands on the issue at hand, there is absolutely nothing illegal in the United States about getting together to just shoot guns with your buddies or practice. I'm not going to be dismissive, but to practice choreography.
Yeah, run some drills, whatever, at your bunker, you know, your whatever it is, barn type situation. I mean, it also makes me think of groups like, forget the name or if they had an official name, but like Ayman Bundy, that was a militia, right? Wasn't like, I mean, David Koresh, you know, things like that. Weren't those kind of militias? But I guess it's about action and intention, right? As to whether you're a terrorist group or a militia or a cult. Sorry, I don't mean to muddy the waters here, Ben, but I do think it's maybe worth a quick aside.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree with you. So the Branch Davidians started as a cult or spiritual belief system before Koresh came in and usurped things. And under the Koresh regime, the Branch Davidians became increasingly like an increasingly militant organization and apocalyptic in their reasoning, right? These things that we would call unsanctioned militias do come from militant organizations, and they don't all have the same aims. They don't all have the same objectives, right? A lot of times you'll find two different groups and they describe themselves as, you know, the last real Americans, and they might meet each other and hate each other and totally disagree on everything else, because real American means one thing to one group and another thing to the other group.
It also leads me to the question of intention again, like, is when you use the term militia versus like armed terrorist group or what have you, is the intention typically, when you're talking about a militia, about nationalism and about protecting, you know, what's ours, what's theirs in terms of their little piece of the United States, or is it greater than that? The sanctioned ones certainly seem like they're designed and meant to aid, you know, the state or the country at large. But some of these, where the ideology gets a little trickier, their aims seem to be a little bit amorphous to me. But I just wonder if that term militia does require some nationalistic leaning.
Often, yes, yeah, because a terrorist operation or a terrorist organization would be attempting to attack the United States. Now, there are cases of militant groups or militant militia-affiliated individuals who commit acts that we would legally consider terrorism. They don't think of themselves as terrorists. They think of themselves as agents of the greater good. Again, as I said earlier, the tricky thing is the intention, right? There's been a lot of work done by the FBI, by various branches of law enforcement, and by some really ballsy journalists, honestly, journalists and authors, to get a better understanding of these groups, right? Which again are disparate, divided, driven by differing goals. And in that, what we find is that often here in the US, these unsanctioned militias do see themselves as a defensive force. And often the reasoning may be one of preparedness for an inevitable disaster or compromise of civilization, rule of law, or they may think that collapse has already occurred and they're fighting to, you know, as you said, protect what they see as theirs. But if they're peacefully assembling, That's in the Constitution too, you know. That's in the letter of the law.
Oh, vehemently protected. in terms, I mean, you know,
right,
like in terms of the ability to bear arms, at least in and of itself. And to your point, Ben, it's not until they do something untoward, let's just say, that they are breaking the law. Just assembling and hanging out, maybe even sleeping in bunks and maybe doing a little prepping and having some ideas that maybe others might find a little over the top. None of those things in and of themselves are illegal.
Yeah, like think about this. I've gone to weekend trips where you are essentially taking a workshop on various aspects of things like survivalism or, you know, firearm training, things like that. Totally legal. How many of those trips can I take before I get on a list? Mm-hmm. Spoiler, right. It's not the number of trips you take, it's the organizations that run the trip. That's what gets you on a list. It's weird because it's such a murky, blurred line. It's what our British friends would call a sticky wicket. So where is the line between this idea of assembling your right to bear arms, guaranteed by the Second Amendment, your right to assemble peacefully, your right to prepare for the possibility of disaster and instability in the future? That's all fine, but when does it become illegal? This is where we go back to the legal experts. Let's pull a quote. I can't remember. This may be from Cornell. It may be from Georgetown, but in general, it's so weird, man, because they're not describing a specific instance of law, right? They're not giving us a rubric. They're saying things like, it kind of reminds me of the old PSAs where they would say, here are some signs that your kids might be on the pot.
Yeah,
you know,
they're like, worshiping the devil.
Right.
It's, you know, some flags, let's just say, some signposts. Things like wearing military style uniforms, possessing and deploying tactical gear, having some sort of identifying insignia, you know, on their military style uniforms, carrying, wielding, using firearms or other such weapons. And here's the thing that kind of throws me a little bit: operating within a coordinated command structure. So to your question, Ben, or your point, yeah, like at what point does it go from being this kind of like simulation, you know, workshop thing to actually running ops? To having that coordinated command structure seems like it's heading in that direction, or it could be heading in that direction. And it's a little scary for that command structure to kind of operate in a vacuum.
Yeah, that command structure is key. And I'm happy that you have that you clocked that as well. A coordinated command structure, the logistics behind the thing can be a big flag, as you noted, because when you have a command structure, you might also begin to have designation of rank. Now, it's not just saying, this guy they call Ben is calling the shots over at our bunker compound. Now it's, you know, Brigadier 18 star, 18 black star.
Wow.
Whatever. Because they're making it up. They're making it up.
Oh,
you know?
Oh, okay. I follow.
He told the adjutant Donkey Wonk or whatever in Idaho that it's time to move the AKs across state lines and make sure that if anyone pulls us over on the road, they contact the guy in law enforcement who's also with the cause.
There you go. So at that point, we're talking about kind of co-opting other parts of legally recognized, you know, branches of state and federal government. I guess the question then becomes about scale and also about running these type of ops that you're talking about. At what point do you go from being a humble militia to being a genuine paramilitary force to be reckoned with operating outside of the real deal, military operated by the U.S. government? Possibly with very different goals and aims, possibly even with goals to overthrow parts of the government and military.
Yeah, this is a series of great questions, and we may not be able to answer them all this evening. Let's go to some crazy facts. These are these are facts that not everybody likes to hear on the political right or the political left. The Second Amendment does guarantee the right to bear arms.
Sorry, every time I hear that, Ben, I can picture I the know. Right it to is, have, you know, bear, I got my bear arms. I'm coming to get
exactly.
you.
Exactly. I think about that too. I had to pause and just go, oh, God, we love this joke. So in guaranteeing the right to bear arms, the Second Amendment does not allow for private paramilitary organizations.
But they just, we just said that they do allow it, though.
We said they allow for peaceful assembly and you can have firearms. And if the governor of a state approves something, you can have a state defense force. But we can't all, you know, at our upcoming live show in Brooklyn, we can't all of a sudden herald the creation of the Williamsburg Strike Force and then give ourselves all titles, uniforms, guns, and begin training.
Can I be the bag man? That's a military
of
term,
course
right?
Yeah.
Thanks, buddy.
Yeah, of course, sure. Brigadier Bagman.
Okay. Oh, I love that. I might even play the bagpipes when we march on Washington.
Great. Or we march on Queens.
Yeah.
You know,
City Hall. Yeah.
Yeah. There we go. The Supreme Court decided that private paramilitary organizations, meaning those unsanctioned by any representative of government, they said this was illegal not once but twice because it keeps coming up. SCOTUS knocked it down in 1886 and then again in 2008.
Because it didn't take the first time, I guess. I wonder if it took the second time. Spoiler alert. I mean, I guess the sticky
like
wicket.
Washing your car.
That's right. The sticky wicket, though, that you mentioned earlier, Ben, is at what point do it's so vague as to when a militia moves into the territory of paramilitary force, and you can't really know unless I guess there are certain quote unquote militias that are maybe approaching that are being monitored, right? Because we're thinking they're going to make a move. Yes. Can we talk about that aspect of it a little bit? Some of the surveillance,
sure,
how far that goes and what puts you on the radar of the federal government.
I like that you're pointing this out. Yeah, because we need to look at the other side of this. Again, there are many people, many organizations, volunteer organizations that have perhaps been unfairly targeted by mass surveillance. You know, I'm sure we have a lot of folks in the audience tonight who are saying, well, yeah, I train, or yes, I'm what you would call a prepper. You know what I mean? But I'm not trying to break the law. I'm just trying to be prepared, right, like any good Boy Scout. So why am I getting targeted? When we see threats to the rule of law on a local, a regional, a federal level, then we, in theory, also see constant investigation, monitoring, infiltration. You could argue that the conspiracy, the infiltration attempts occur on both sides. So the FBI or, you know, the state level version of it, like here in Georgia, we have the GBI, the Georgia Bureau of Investigation. They will monitor these things in concert with the FBI, in concert with local law enforcement. They may send somebody in to learn more about an organization, more about what they actually want to do. Is this a neo-Nazi organization? Is this a hate group of some kind, a supremacist group of some kind? Or are these people who, I don't know, it's nuts because I have always suspected, I've never really looked into this, but I've always suspected the monitoring drills down so far that at least a few undercover folks have even gone to Civil War reenactments just to check in, just to be like, hey, you guys know this is reenactment, right?
Yeah, okay, but just for funsies. All 50 states, however, I guess to answer my own question from earlier, they don't prohibit the organizations themselves, but they do prohibit these unauthorized militia and military units from engaging in activities that would typically be reserved for the state militia. And that includes peacekeeping efforts. you know, enforcing the law.
Right, right. Like when you start trying to run checkpoints at the edge of your town, that is something law enforcement needs to do. That is something the sheriff should be in charge of, you know, not us in the gang. And so you, like, on what authority are you stopping that car? That's a great example of where this stuff can get pretty crazy.
Well, at the end of the day, you know, might makes right. I mean, not really, but you know, if you have a gun, that's enough to enforce it. If you got enough people behind you with the gun, that are all, you know, moving towards the same goals. So, like, I mean, at the end of the day, if a militia, a private militia, were to develop or go unnoticed or whatever and combine forces perhaps with some other groups, that could potentially rival larger, more organized state militias. They'd be the ones in charge, wouldn't they?
If things go wrong, if the rule of law does not hold.
That's exactly what
I mean. And that's the thing. Yeah, the rule of law is a... is a social covenant. You know, it's kind of like how people have faith in the stock market or people have faith in physical currency. It works so long as everybody agrees that it works.
Well, and I think we're seeing a lot of this too in the current administration and their ability to just kind of try things out and go against this sort of decorum of what a president or what a government, a presidential cabinet is historically meant to do and meant to be. And you sort of realize that the only thing holding all this together is people kind of just behaving themselves in the past.
Yeah.
And then the moment someone decides to, you know, get ballsy with it and test the waters, there aren't a whole lot of things in place to keep them from doing that.
There are a whole lot of things written to prevent that, but I've never seen a piece of paper stop a bullet.
Exactly.
Is the very cold way to say it. And, you know, there's another fact that gets ignored in mainstream media. It's this: government overreach can be real. Government forces get the privilege of deciding at their own discretion which groups are or are not considered illegal militia. And it's completely possible that some groups can be unfairly targeted. You do not have to look too far back into American history to find multiple examples of this. Think of the civil rights movement, right? Sure. You know, think of gun control is nowadays a pretty wholesome and well-intentioned concept in the modern version. Now, critics of gun control obviously are going to say an Orwellian force is taking away your right to protect itself or yourself, and once that right is gone, you'll never get it back. We understand that. We're giving you that argument, that perspective. But then flip it and think about the fact that people who are proponents of gun control are saying, hey, we have an extraordinary and disgusting amount of mass shootings, school shootings especially, right? This could be prevented, and the fastest answer, say proponents of gun control, obviously, is to fix these firearm laws. But the origin of gun control in the U.S. today, the concept itself, as well-intentioned as it is, as wholesome as it is in its modern version, as aspirational noble as it is, it has some pretty disturbing racist roots at its foundation, because people got the powers that be got a lot more concerned about gun control when they saw African American people.
Sure. Organizations like the Black Panthers.
Learning more about rights. Exactly. Right. Self-defense initiatives. That is part of what triggered gun control as a rationale to smack down those folks. And we're not saying that's the case now, but we're saying it's important to acknowledge that these wholesome things can sometimes have insidious origins. You know, this gets us back to this militia thing, because you could call something a militia if you just objected to the people, right? Peaceful protesters, you know, and there's maybe there's a group of gun-toting vegans. They're not gonna, you know, they're not gonna overrun the zoo or any, or like a meatpacking plant or anything. They're just doing weird commune lifestyle thing. And now you call them a militia because you don't like them.
Well, it's like the term radical, you know? Like, yeah. Nobody calls themselves radicals. It's just the opposition that call you radicals as a term of abuse.
Mm-hmm.
Or a thought-terminating cliche.
Yes, a thought-terminating cliche where a phrase is weaponized to avoid further scrutiny. And again, to bring it all together, these concerns are coming up because the laws are confusing, because things are amorphous, and because there are loopholes that can be exploited. This is only the beginning of a larger conversation. Folks, thanks for tuning in. The big takeaway here is that, yes, state defense forces are legal. And yes, there are groups that say they are state defense forces or aspire to be, and those are, depending on their actions and intentions, very much not legal. And the line is a gradient.
But there are versions of them, depending on their actions and intentions, that could be considered just fine.
100%. Yeah. Until they go paramilitary. This is a pickle. We're raising more questions than answers, which is why this is why we consider this a part one of a larger exploration. And we'd love to hear more from you, fellow conspiracy realists. Have you been involved with a local militia or a state defense force? Are you currently involved with one, sanctioned or unsanctioned? We cannot stress this enough. The law in your part of the U.S. may differ. We'd also love to hear from folks in other parts, in like what's it like in your neck of the global woods if you don't live in the United States? How does your country treat these organizations? What do those organizations do? How do they work? How do the laws around them work? We cannot wait to hear from you. We may have a part two on the way. Again, we're with you. We're sussing this out ourselves, and we'd love your help. You can find us online. You can find us on email. You can find us on a telephonic device.
Yeah, first and foremost, well, not foremost, just first, you can find us all over the internet to handle conspiracy stuff, where we exist on Facebook with our Facebook group, Here's Where It Gets Crazy, on YouTube, where we have video content galore for your perusing enjoyment, as well as on X, FKA Twitter, on Instagram and TikTok, however, we're Conspiracy Stuff Show, and also, we're people. I'm How Now Noel Brown on Instagram. How about you, Ben?
You can find me at on Instagram. You can also go meet me at the appropriate monument at midnight in just on the outskirts monument of your city. Midnight monument coming soon to a moonless night near you. You can also, if you wish, and the rumors are true here, and Noel, give us a call on a telephonic device.
That's right. We're 1-833-STDWYTK. You can leave a voicemail message of your choosing. Tell us what you think about an episode. Give us ideas for another episode. The time is yours and yours alone. Just be sure to give yourself a clever nickname. Doesn't have to be clever, even just a nickname. And let us know if it's cool to use your message on the air. And Ben, could we do a quick plug for this thing we're doing? We're doing a live show as part of On Air Fest on February the 19th at this incredible venue called National Sawdust in Williamsburg, Brooklyn.
Yes. The rumors are true. Stuff They Don't Want You to Know presents A Conspiracy of Sound. We don't want to spoil it too much, but we've got a lot of surprises for you ahead. Let's say it this way. You can see the show at 7:30. You can join the show at 6:30.
Yeah, or even 6, I think. We are also just a little tiny tease. National Sawdust is a very audio-forward venue with a crazy array of immersive speakers hidden in the walls of their incredibly beautifully designed space, and we're going to make use of all of that, both before, after, and during the show. So come check it out. You can find more info at National Sawdust website or On Air Fest.
And we'll also possibly, we're still waiting to hear back, we'll possibly have an appearance by our parent company, Illumination Global Unlimited. Can't wait for you to hear it. Can't wait for you to be there and see it. Can't wait for you to be part of the show. Speaking of part of the show, if you have links, if you have photographs, if you have a burning question on your mind, please always write to us. We can all see it when you write. We can all respond. We're available for these internet communiques 24 hours a night, 7 evenings a week. All you have to do is walk a little further from the light. Join us out here in the dark. We are
conspiracy@iheartradio.com.
Stuff They Don't Want You to Know is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Folks, we bet you know at least a handful of people that are taking Ozempic, semaglutide, or other similar medications, and they're doing so for good reason. These are groundbreaking ways for changing quality of life, and future health makes accessing them simple, safe, and affordable.
Yeah, obesity affects roughly 42% of U.S. adults, according to the CDC. And I am actually someone who's struggled with weight loss in the past, and I've had great results from trying some of these GLP-1s in the past myself.
Just take their quick 3-minute survey. From there, if approved by a clinician, you'll get prescribed and get meds delivered to your door within 24 hours.
So don't delay. Find out if weight loss meds are right for you in 3 minutes at tryfh.com. That's tryfh.com. Again, tryfh.com. Future Health is not a healthcare services provider. Meds are prescribed at provider's discretion. Results may vary. Sponsored by Future Health.
Are you still quoting 30-year-old movies? Have you said cool beans in the past 90 days? Do you think Discover isn't widely accepted? If this sounds like you, you're stuck in the past. Discover is accepted at 99% of places that take credit cards nationwide. And every time you make a purchase with your card, you automatically earn cash back. Welcome to the now. It pays to Discover. Learn more at discover.com/creditcard. Based on the February 2024 Nielsen report.
How to have fun. Anytime. Anywhere. Step 1. Go to ChumbaCasino.com.
ChumbaCasino.com. Got it.
Step 2. Collect your welcome bonus.
Come to Papa, welcome bonus.
Step 3. Play hundreds of casino-style games for free.
That's a lot of games. All for free?
Step 4. Unleash your excitement.
Woohoo! Chumba Casino has been delivering thrills for over a decade. So claim your free welcome bonus now and live the Chumba life. Visit ChumbaCasino.com.
VGW Group. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Did you know? 56% of people swipe right on dating profiles with genuine smiles, but those same profiles fizzle out with overfiltered or repetitive pictures. Facetune helps you create pics that pop without losing authenticity. Fix lighting, enhance your features, and turn an ordinary pic into a professional-level shot. Don't leave it to luck. Take control of your first impression. With flawless lighting and just the right angle, your profile won't just be good. It'll be authentically you. Search Facetune in the App Store or Google Play to download, and watch the matches roll in.